Sarvamangalamangale Shive Sarvarthasadhike Sharanye Triambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. Salutations to the Divine Mother, Mother of all mothers, who art the fulfiller of all our needs and desires, and the refuge for us from all distress, who art both dark and fair, salutations to thee ever, salutations to thee. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavahe Namastu, Ma Virchavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. May the Divine Being, may the Divine Being
support and be gracious to the Mother and Father.
May we have the strength and skill
to study together in the art of spirituality.
May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.
Om peace, peace, peace be unto us all.
This is the guru bead, it should not test. Last Sunday we had the celebration of Gautama Buddha's birth, enlightenment, and disappearance. And so I thought, as is customary, I would talk today quite a bit about Buddhism. In our centers, it is customary on the occasion of the thrice blessed day, or close to it, to give a talk, a discourse on the life and teachings of Buddha. And pretty much we go over the same old familiar ground, and I have done it for years, and I thought that this morning I would depart from tradition and not give you what probably is pretty familiar to most of you by this time, and talk instead about Hinduism and Buddhism contrasted. Looking at both faiths, more or less from the outside instead of from inside, as if I were a scholar of comparative religion or a student of religion and had an exercise in comparing Hinduism and Buddhism, I think that it may be more, some of it may be more new to you and more interesting, certainly to me anyway, who have had to give it so many years. So we're going to look at it as more of a contrast and compare differences and similarities between the two great world faiths. They have very much in common. As you understand, of course, Buddhism grew out of Hinduism. Buddha was a Hindu. I mean, if there is such a thing as a Hindu, Buddha was born in the Hindu culture. He grew up in a family of nobility, a minor princedom, somewhere near Nepal. And his family were practicing the religion and culture of India of 600 B.C. So, and he is, as far as we know, as far as anybody knows, as far as we're sure, he's a historical figure. He was a historical person. We're more sure of his existence than we are that of Jesus, who comes later, supposedly. Throughout the Buddhist employment of religious symbols and ideas, you find everything coming from Hinduism. You find the use of the word Om, Om standing as the primary sacred symbol. It's not called the name of God in Buddhism. It's called, it's just given the sacredness, respect and reverence as would be given to the most important word in any language. Insofar as one entire group of Buddhists uses the Sanskrit language, Northern Buddhism uses primarily the Sanskrit language for its scriptures. And even the Southern school of Buddhism, the Pali and Prakrit schools of Buddhism use derivatives of Sanskrit. So all of the vocabulary comes down, the same ideas flow through both religions. You can hardly read a Buddhist scripture or a text of any kind without feeling that this is right out of the ancient Vedas. This is derivative, just as you hear the music of a composer, sort of a hack in later days, and you say, oh, well, we don't give him much credit, his music is derivative. It means that there was a more classical piece somewhere before him of which this is redolent, which is reminiscent. There is that feeling about the Buddhist treatment of the basic truth, that they are, in a sense, derivative. But that doesn't diminish their glory in any way, as far as I'm concerned. There are so much more in common between the two faiths than there is difference that I could go on for a long time just delineating the commonalities. But that is perhaps less important than for us than some of the differences, because after all, they are two distinguishable world faiths which are adhered to by millions and millions of people throughout the world. So what is different between them is more perhaps interesting than the commonalities. But I don't want you to feel that they are in any way of different source or origin, because they are not. It grew up right out of the Hindu milieu. Well, it starts with Gautama. Gautama was the clan family name of Prince Siddhartha, who, as you know, was born in a palace and kept away from the world. And his father was afraid that he would become a monk and wander off and not inherit the kingdom. He was the only son, and the family was very jealous of his time and his future, did their best to keep him at home. But as young men have a way of doing, he became an adolescent and wandered off into the city, asking his charioteer to take him through the parts he had never seen. And he comes across these various people, an old person that he had never seen before, an ill, very ill person he had never seen before, a corpse on the road, lying by the road. He didn't understand, asked his charioteer, what is this? Oh, this, sir, this is death. And then finally he sees a young sannyasin with shining face, head erect, marching through the city with his begging bowl and having no problem about life, seemingly free, wandering. And he compared all these experiences, you know, and that was what started him on his quest for the highest truth. And his life, as I say, I'm not going to go into detail today because I've done it so often and you know the basic facts. Went off, studied with the yogis of the day, whoever they were. That's one of the most important points in my presentation this morning. It's doubtful that those teachers whom he names, who were supposedly teachers of the Veda or of yoga, it's doubtful that they were very well educated or prepared. Probably they were not. Most probably they were not people who could accurately present to him the philosophy of Vedanta, especially Advaita. But he had a monistic turn of mind, and he saw around him all of the foolishness, the hypocrisy of the priests of the day, people saying, "I am Brahman, I am the Atman," who were not in any way fit to be saying that, whose lives did not demonstrate that they were knowers of Brahman. He saw all this, just as Jesus saw the hypocrisy of the scribes and Pharisees. And so he launched out on his own. He said, "I've got to find this quest myself. I can't depend on teachers." And he spent 6 years practicing the most severe austerities and became a very lean and hungry skeleton of a man, depicted in some of the artist's conceptions, and full of asceticism and austerity, and then not realizing that was not the way, he found what he calls the middle path, discovered the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path to Nirvana. And then he spends 45 years ministering to his society, to his monks, gathering hundreds of monks and nuns into monastic orders, and traveling throughout the north of India, making peace between warring tribes and giving Solomon-like judgments in situations, receiving all kinds of people, prostitutes and others, just like Jesus did. Well, that's, and then died at the age of 80-something. That's a quick passing over of his life history. Swami Vivekananda talked a great deal about Buddha. He wrote and talked all his life about Gautama Buddha because that, he said, was his ishtam, his chosen ideal. He called him the greatest man that ever lived. Greatest man that ever lived. Cited him as the ideal karma yogi, one who sought nothing for himself, made no claims of divinity, made no separation between himself and other men, said that other people, men or women, could attain to this same state of enlightenment, Buddhahood, that he had and he was. If I gave you all of the things that Swami Vivekananda said about him, it would fill this discourse. I can do that, and I have done it on other occasions. It takes a whole morning's discourse to talk about Swami Vivekananda and Buddha because there is so much to say. He commented on his philosophy. He commented on his psychology. He commented on his life. He commented on his teachings. and on his significance for the world. So there is an enormous amount there, and I'm just brushing over it. I've given you the highlights. He called him the ideal sannyasin, the perfect sannyasin par excellence. The essence of monkhood, and that his life was so dramatic in the sense that even in face of high criticism, he could leave his wife and newborn child and, putting all behind him, walk off into the woods for what? God knows what. He knew not what. Now, the irony of it is that although Buddha left the fold of Hinduism, I don't mean officially, but in essence, in practice, he left the Hindu culture, the Brahmin culture, the caste system, and the society, the whole Hindu society. He left that behind and launched a new movement, so to speak. And he and the movement considered him nothing but a man. And the Hindu community kept him and called him an avatar. This is a strange part about it. The Hindu community accepted him as a prophet. And many Hindus count him among the avatars, the incarnations of God. He's always referred to by the Hindu, worshipping Hindus, as Buddha Deva, Lord Buddha, Buddha Deva. The Hindu mind always sees divinity behind the human, always wants to see the divine behind the so-called human, carries everything of this level up to another level, to a transcendent level. That's the nature of the Hindu mind. Buddha didn't think that way. He didn't seek a god. Whatever god had been taught to him or talked to him, he didn't find significant, didn't find real. But he knew there was a subconscious state, and he wanted to find that state. He suspected there was such a state. The yogis hadn't been able to give it to him. And he found it and said, this is Buddhahood, it means being awakened, and you can be awakened, and then just as I am awakened, and there have been many. See, the tradition is carried on. What did he say? He said, I am the latest Buddha. Behind and before me there were many Buddhas. That continuity, that's a Hindu idea. That's not something born new. The Hindu idea is that God comes here again and again and again in new vestments, new forms, new clothing. Buddha didn't call it God. He called it awakenedness. And he said, there has been here on earth many times. I'm only the latest one. So that is another strange bit of irony, that Hinduism keeps him in its fold as Jews did not keep Jesus. Just think of what I've often mentioned this to you. Think of what the history of the world would have been. How many less wars there would have been fought if the Jewish community, religion, had said, oh yes, Jesus is one of our great prophets. We don't call him divine. We don't call any of our prophets God, but we call them prophets, and they are continually revealing to us greater and greater truths in a succession. Had the Jewish faith been able to accept Jesus, or Muhammad for that matter, Muhammad also, this would have been a different world. They're called the people of the book, but the Jews don't consider that they are people of the book. The Muslims call themselves and the Christians people of the book. Well, in Hinduism, we have so many books, but the Vedas, see, that's the beauty of the Veda. The Veda is so transcendental. The Vedic teachings are so high, so lofty, so far above stories and agendas and compacts with God and Puranas and all of the stories and histories and God's special people that make divisions between religions. Hinduism has this wonderful comprehensive capacity of enfolding and encompassing and including everything, so that when there is a new movement starts up, it can say, ah, yes, bless you. You too belong to us. Yes, this is another form of our eternal truth. How different it would have been, the history of the West. So, well, let's look at this now. Are they really mother and daughter, Hinduism and Buddhism? Well, yes and no. Because in India, yes, they grew up. You see, there was a long period. There was a period perhaps from 300 BC when people were being converted. No, I should say. There was a period from the end of Buddha's life and the beginning of his following for several centuries where the Chinese pilgrim came over and discovered there were Brahmanas and Shramanas worshipping side by side in temples next to each other. Just as you go to India today and you will see Shakta temples and Vaishnava temples and Shaiva temples scattered throughout the cities in different parts and even together, a block or two away. It wouldn't make any difference to anybody. In that way, Buddhism and Hinduism were being practiced in the early years after Buddha's death. There were Buddhist temples and Hindu temples mixed in the city, mixed diversely, without distinction. Then only gradually, and this is what happens in every faith that separates itself from an older faith, every sect which moves outside the main culture and goes traveling abroad, it gets identified with people of other countries and it becomes separated from its mother, and then that faith starts being very self-conscious. We are no longer Sanatana Dharma people. We didn't have the word Hindu. They are Sanatana Dharma. We are no longer Sanatana Dharma people. We are Buddhists. Similarly with Sikhs. Sikhs were no longer Hindus. They were Sikhs. And all of that happens. So in a sense, mother and daughter, yes. And yet in the beginning, they were more like sisters, almost indistinguishable. In the case of Judaism, of course, Judaism sometimes recognizes Christianity as a daughter faith. It has to. And Islam too. But Islam and Christianity do not really like to call themselves children of Judaism. I don't think very many people would like to say that. But the comparison, there's a certain analogical comparison here. Well, here is another contrast. Hinduism has a cohesion. A cohesion, is that the right word? It has a, I couldn't find the right word for it, but I came up with cohesion. Hinduism has a a contiguity, a cohesion which keeps it a whole in spite of all its numerous subdivisions. See, how many there are? There are the six systems of philosophy, first of all. Six systems of philosophy. That's the most ancient division. Then there were the Brahmins and the Sankhyans. The Sankhya system, one of the six philosophies. There was a large school of Sankhya philosophy at one time. It disappeared. And then there were the atheists. Atheists was one of the schools that were heterodox, but the strange part about Hinduism is that it has this cohesion which pats you on the head and says, oh, you are an atheist? Okay. All right. Come in. Open the door. You're still in our fold. Yes, yes, yeah, there are people in the Vedas who said maybe even God doesn't know. So, if you are an atheist, it's okay. They're heterodox, but they're not orthodox, but they are still. In other words, Hinduism has this capacity as mother, and this is Mother's Day, so we'll give them credit. It has a capacity to absorb, to contain, to shelter and to nourish every kind of religious view which has come into its awareness. And so in that sense, it has a cohesion which defies its innumerable subdivisions, Shaktas, Vaishnavas, Shaivites, Shaiva Siddhanta. I can give you a long list of the names of Tantras, Agamas, so many kinds of sects and divisions and leaders and saints and sages that have started their own little groups. And yet it holds all this together in a kind of way that Buddhism does not. Buddhism is divided quite rather sharply into three principal schools. So different, you might almost call them different religions. There is, as you know, I suppose, the Theravadin school, sometimes pejoratively called Hinayana, meaning lesser, by the Mahayanists, the greater people. But the proper name for them is Theravadins, and they are found in the countries of Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, and sometimes in other pockets elsewhere. Those are the main principal countries where they are found now. Cambodia, some there were. These are the Theravadins, and they call themselves the original Buddhists. Or did you ever hear that before? The original souls. We're the original Buddhas. Then there is the northern school which went out of India, out of North India, by missionaries, Buddhist missionaries, to Nepal, to Ladakh, and to Tibet. And those countries are Mahayanists. They are practicers of what's called Mahayana Buddhism. Mixed it is with the native bone religion and other sects that were found up in that area. And that religion went over to the east and spread itself into into Korea. Korea, and from Korea to, from into China. China to Korea, Korea to Japan. Became Zen and Chan and all of the Chinese and Japanese forms of Buddhism. There are so many. So this is the history of the northern school of Buddhism. And then we can count Zen in Japan as almost a separate school. So different are the teachings. So different are the practices. So different, so far has it got away from the original story of the life of Buddha, that Zen Buddhism can practically be called a different faith. And if you bring all these together, you don't find the kinds of things that you find in Hinduism. You don't find an overarching, basic ground of understanding on which they can all agree. Maybe the monastic life would be the nearest thing you could, and even that's very different in all these countries. So, but notice this, Hinduism has the umbrella, but it was Buddhism that scattered and spread the influence. Buddhism is a far more widespread religion now than Hinduism. Far more widespread, far more influential in the world, more influential in the West and in America. Because it has that missionarizing tendency, the tendency to go out and preach, to conquer new fields and to present itself to new cultures. That spreading tendency, that capacity to missionarize, carry a message, a simple message to the world, has made Buddhism more influential in the world than Hinduism. In the sense of external, I don't mean in the sense of ideas necessarily, but in the sense of all the external things. Buddhism has almost become three religions in general. Well, let's come to the teachings. Let's compare the teachings of Hindus and the teachings of the Buddhists a little bit. It's a very big subject, and I don't pretend to have exhaustively prepared it today, but I think when you look at the two, you have to say Buddhism is basically a negative path. The beauty and glory of Nirvana is not stressed so much as is the renunciation of the world, the leaving behind of all desires, of all selfishness, of all the littleness of life. The do-nots are emphasized perhaps more than the do's. And so I would really characterize Buddhism as primarily a negative path. Now, that does not mean that there isn't a negative path in Hinduism. You know what it is. We call it Jnana Yoga. We call it the path of knowledge, the path of discrimination between the unreal and the real. The leaving behind of the unreal, the shucking off of all our upadhis, our adventitious supernumerary superimposition, all these big words we use to describe what's clinging to us and what we have to shake off. So we have our path. And it's even found in Christianity. It's called the apophatic. It's called the via negativa in Latin. What is via? Via the way, life or way. Negativa. The negative path of Christian mysticism, of Christian practice, is found there in Christianity. So every great religion probably has its negative dimension as well as its positive dimension. But you see, you take Hinduism in the form in which it's presented by Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda, it's mainly positive. Negative, Jnana Yoga is there, but Jnana Yoga is taught in such a way that you are emphasizing the beauty of God knowledge, God realization. The beauty of samadhi, the greatness of samadhi, the attainment of samadhi. How different your life is when you are bound and selfish and limited and small. How much more beautiful your life is when it is expanded. When it stems from the capital S self. And when God is your friend or your companion or your mother or your father or your child. See, the richness of spiritual experience, the richness of spiritual life and experience is what we derive from our Hindu background. I don't find that emphasis anywhere so much in Buddhism. I maybe have missed it, but That's one of the contrasts that I would bring up first of all. Buddhism gives an ethic, and this is perhaps where it succeeds best. It gives you a simple, easily stated ethic to apply throughout your whole life, in your family life, your work life, your spiritual life, your moral life, not in the detail that, say, Confucius gives it to China, but in outline and in simple, easy steps. Eightfold path. Right thinking, right speaking, right meditation. That comes to it. Right, livelihood, and so on. All these easy steps. You take the parts of your life and apply to them the principles of ahimsa, the principles of a loving compassion, metta, and so on. All these Pali terms, they come from Sanskrit. But Buddha set out his ethical system in a very simple and non-philosophical way. And that is one of the great strengths, you see, of Buddhism, that it gives people, simple people, people on the outskirts of the Hindu society, tribes on the borders who were less cultivated, less educated, and so on, had a chance to come in under this simple formula, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And not that that has succeeded in producing generations of saints. It hasn't. There are people, rascally people in Buddhism, in the Golden Triangle, selling drugs. I mean, there are rascals everywhere. And the history of Buddhism has not produced amongst the society any much greater amount of saintliness and morality than Jesus' teachings have, if I may say so. So the playing out of this formulae has not been necessarily a success, but I think that is one of its strengths. Is Buddhism Dhyana Yoga? Well, yes, in a way it is. It comes from the Sankhya system, the Sankhya system of Prakriti and Purusha, and its cosmological, its cosmology. The Prakriti and the elements and so on have been taken over by Buddhism. I suppose you may not know that a great Hindu physician of some centuries before Gautama analyzed disease in exactly the same four ways that Buddha analyzed suffering. There is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there is a cure for suffering, and there is a way out, a plan to get out of it. And in the same way, his name was Schust. What is it? I forgot the name now. It starts with S. I'm getting a senior moment. He diagnosed disease in just that same sequence. Whether that's what Buddha picked up or whether it came to him separately, people do discover things originally separately. I don't know, but anyway, the roots of all of this are there in Sankhya philosophy. Hinduism is not always Jnana Yoga. We have our devotion and our paths of devotion and paths of work and so on. Hinduism, especially through Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda, purports to give us the science of religion. And I think this is one of the most important distinctions between modern Hinduism and all the other religions of the world that I am familiar with, and I'm familiar with most of them. We believe that religion is a science. We believe and we know from experience that religion can be understood and practiced rationally. That we don't have to mystify it or make great secrets out of it. Nothing esoteric has to be there in the practice of Hinduism. Of Vedanta, I should call it now. I've been talking Hinduism, but I would prefer to call it Vedanta, because I'm talking about the Vedantic part of Hinduism. You know, there are parts which claim not to be Vedantic. Hare Krishna temple, call it Vedanta, always. But the Vedantic aspect of Hinduism teaches us that we can practice and understand religion scientifically, that it must be a science. What others have experienced before, we can experience now for ourselves. That aspect is there in Buddhism, in what Buddha said about Buddhahood, yes. But the rest of religion, he didn't make any attempt to explain. Why are people doing puja? Why are people doing rituals? Why do people have personal relationships with God and so on? That was not in his... He threw it out. He threw all that out. He threw out the caste system in his faith. He threw out the worship of, and along with animal sacrifice and so on. But the science of why people do these things, why human nature raises such issues and phenomena, why these things are satisfying to the human soul, and what they do for us, and so on. That is the science of religion, and that science is something which we find only in Vedanta, so far as I know. Hinduism has... This time I have to say Hinduism instead of Vedanta. Hinduism has a military strain in it that Buddhism does not have. This has to be acknowledged. That military strain is in the Bhagavad Gita, of course, where the ideal karma yogi is chosen as a soldier. A soldier is chosen as the ideal karma yogi. That's in itself a military strain. And then you take such scriptures as the Devi Mahatmyam, the Chandi. Can you imagine anything more violent, anything more warlike, anything more tremendously battlefield placed than the Chandi? Of course, it's all allegorical, sure. Divine Mother is putting down the demons. But blood and guts, it's all thunder and blood and guts. That you don't find so much in Buddhism. I think some of the Tibetan scriptures have violence in them. But by and large, the picture of Tibet is more of Buddhism is more like Jainism. It emphasizes ahimsa as the highest virtue. Gentleness, compassion, non-injury, non-violence. Gandhi was really more of a Buddhist than a Hindu in this respect. Of course, he had Jain antecedents also. But that's a difference which runs down through. When you take the history of Hinduism, the emphasis on Shivaji and on the various military heroes that have sprung up, Netaji and so on. Hinduism has blessed military heroes throughout its history, at least some part of Hinduism has. But you don't find that in Buddhism.
The Ramayana.
Who?
The Ramayana,
yes. Ramayana and Mahabharata. Mahabharata are full of it. Well, on the question of monasticism, let's make a comparison. In the Hindu tradition, the early tradition of the Hindus was the four varnashram, the four stages of life: studentship, householder, marriage and householder life, retirement or abandonment of the house and going to the forest, and finally sannyasa or total renunciation, leaving hearth and home and going out on foot. This was the original plan. Then, of course, the establishment of the institution of monasticism came, even before Buddha, and that took people out of their life in the world as monks, wandering monks. And sometimes they formed communities like Shankara's. But by and large, the Hindu idea of monasticism was of being a solitary, a hermit, going out, depending on no one, and asking God to supply all your wants and needs. And Buddhist monasticism became institutionalized in all of the countries where Buddhism has gone. There have been strong monastic institutions, monasteries, viharas, ashramas, they called them viharas, where people lived and practiced their monastic life in the company of others, going out and coming back informally, more or less, with more or less formality depending on the order. But in Buddhism, a strange new thing came up, and that was that you could be a monk for a part of your life. You could withdraw, especially men, not so much women. Men could withdraw from the world or their business, leave everything behind, suddenly leave, or from their studies, go to the monastery and become monks for a year or 2 years or even less, and leave without any criticism, without any opprobrium, go back to married life or whatever, business life. This is still the pattern in most of the Buddhist countries. You can be a monk for some days, some weeks, some months, a few years, and nobody says anything about it. It's quite different in Hindu monasticism. It's expected to be a lifelong vow. Nobody is supposed to take final vows. Novitiate is different. Novitiate can go back. But in final vows of a Hindu monk, there is no going back. It's great. There's great scorn and criticism for anybody who retires from sannyasa. So there's this difference. I think the greatest of all the Buddhist teachings is the teaching of impermanence. This world is not for real. this not, I shouldn't use the word real, this word is not forever. Real it may be, we won't quibble about that because we define the word reality differently. But for the Buddhist, this world, real or no real, is unlasting, not lasting. It is temporal, passing, a shadow which will pass away. And everything that we cling to, everything that we own, everything that we are, everything we think we are, is vanishing, evanescent. It goes away. I think that is really the, it's a negative teaching, as I said, it's a negative teaching, and it is, I think, the most important of the Buddhist teachings, to give everyone a feeling of how ephemeral this life is, what a shadow it is, how uncertain, shaky, how shaky this world is, your life in this world. That's emphasized more than anything else. In all, if there's anything, I suppose, that binds the three Buddhist religions together, it would be this. All things, O monks, are passing. All things are impermanent. Cling not to anything here. Cling not. And you know, the strange part of it is that officially there is no Buddhist school that I know of which posits an eternal anything behind the passing show is not affirmed. In fact, more often denied than affirmed. Sometimes denied, sometimes left noncommittal. Is there anything behind all this passing show? Is there a permanent? Is there a Brahman? Is there a God? Is there a soul, an eternal soul? All these questions come up. And the Buddhist answer is, Buddha did not say. That's the best answer you can get, is Buddha did not say so. Other answers, other Buddhists will answer, he denied it. He said there isn't. There isn't anything behind this. Shunya. Shunya, empty, void. And yet, you know, I read in the Yoga Journal an article by a modern Buddhist writing on meditation and how to live a meditative life. She writes, cling to the eternal. What is that eternal? Cling to the eternal. Several times in the essay that I read, she talks about clinging to the eternal. I don't know if the Buddhists will spank her or what, but anyway, you see, we say this, it's only human nature and only logical that if you have a passing phenomenon, a show thrown upon a screen, that screen must be there. Without a screen, how can you project? How can you see any passing show? And so we have our Vedic truth, the Vedic truth of chit, consciousness, the screen on which everything is thrown, must be the witness of all this. Anyway, that's another a day's story. I'm not going into that. I just wanted to point it out. I want to say a few words before we close about my journey, my own journey, and what makes it possible for me to talk about it this much. I discovered Gautama, Buddha, way up in the mountains, the high Sierras in California. Not the high Sierras, the middle Sierras in California. When in the wartime, I was serving there in the camp, and somebody came along and dropped off some books. I know who he was. He later became a great Orientalist. But in those days, he was just a mule driver. And he came, brought by mule, a couple of books as well as our our cooking supplies, our food. It was a spike camp, boot camp. And this one book was The Wisdom of China and India by Lin Yutang. And the other one was The Story of Oriental Philosophy by L. Adams Beck. These books are so old that now nobody reads them or buys them. That book by L. Adams Beck introduced me to the life of Buddha. And I was fascinated. I was fascinated. I read the Ramayana at the same time, excerpts that are given in The Wisdom of China and India. But the life that caught me was the life of Gautama. I couldn't see there was all that much difference between his life and teachings and those of the Jesus that I worshipped. And so my life and passage went down quite two directions from there on. At Chabuco College, where I first began to get acquainted with monastic life, there was a Theravadin nun, Sister Dhammadinna, about whom I have told you some before. She was an illustrative example of a Sri Lankan Theravadin nun. Though she was a convert, she was European, who had converted. And she taught us the wheel of the law, the Dharma. And you see, her teaching and her example were so entrancing, I almost became her disciple. I can say that I was her disciple up until one day when she said, in answer to a question, well, I can remember what the question was. We were just a small group of people that were in Gerald Hurd's Chabuco College, and she was a visitor, a guest there teaching. And she taught us many things about Buddhism from the standpoint of Theravada. And somebody asked her to compare her teachings with those of Jesus in some connection. I've forgotten which. And she cleared her throat and hemmed and hawed and said, I will sit up with you all night turning the wheel of the doctrine. But do not ask me about other religions. She wasn't willing to discuss. And that's a characteristic that still clings to Buddhism. There's some kind of fear there. There's some kind of inadequacy that makes them shy away from discussing philosophical questions or differences between faiths. I once succeeded in getting a Buddhist-Hindu dialogue in Ganges Monastery, of which I'm rather proud because I think it was the only one that's ever been held. But that's difficult. They don't want to talk about other religions. And that was my point of departure. That's when I said, I can't go with this. I'm not going to take up a narrow faith that cannot discuss religion as a science. And I came back. It was a side trip I took into Buddhism. I came back to Vedanta and realized what had been given me already and where my place was to be and what I was to become and to talk about, to study and to preach. Otherwise, I came very close to becoming a Theravadin. Well, there are signs today of rapprochement. There are signs of reconnoitering. rebuilding relationship. For one thing, the three kinds of Buddhists are meeting together and trying to find common ground, and it's amazing how much that's going on that never took place until this century. All this is the advent of been built. All this is built on the advent of Sri Ramakrishna. It's Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda who have changed the mentality of the world. The whole mental philosophy and mental culture and color of the world have been changed by this Vedantic revelation, because you find the Buddhists are coming together, the Jews and the Christians are coming together. I can give you so many examples of Jewish groups who are meeting with Christians, Christians who are going to synagogues, Jews who are going to churches, and they're trying to get together and understand how this happened, this great schism happened between the Jewish and the Hebrew and the Nazarenes. So today's things are different. I'll give you one more little story. At Trabuco College, Trabuco Monastery rather, when it had become a monastery, we, some friends of ours, invited D.T. Suzuki to come to our meditation, which precedes lunch. I don't know if you know who Suzuki was. He's the author of The Way of the Zen Monk and many other books on Buddhism. He was at the Parliament. No, I don't think he was at the Parliament. One of his predecessors was at the Parliament of Religions, where Swami Vivekananda spoke. And he was the primary a source for introducing religion to America, Buddhist religion to America. His were the first books that came over, and he lived to be a very old man. When he was an old man, he came to our monastery. He humbly, silently slipped into the meditation room before lunch and meditated with us. Then he came out and had lunch with us, and we talked humorous and interesting things together. We were all very polite to each other. The Swami was at the head of the table, and he was the chief guest. One thing that he said that I remember before he had got up from the table was, "Yes, I think we Buddhists have been negligent of the path of devotion." This from the great authority on Buddhism. "Yes, I think we Buddhists have been negligent of the path of devotion." I don't know anybody that's ever repeated that except me. I may be the only person that remembers it. I can tell you those were his words. Well, today the Dalai Lama is responsible for a much more wonderful presentation and picture of Buddhism than we've ever had before. I'd call him one of the greatest men living today. Thich Nhat Hanh has been another who's done a lot to bring Buddhism and Christianity together. And the Dalai Lama has set such wonderful examples for us. And I think we can look forward to a day when we will be able to understand much better than we did for many a century the intricate and surprising and beautiful relationship between these two great world faiths. And I ask for your comments or questions.
Swami, I have two questions and possibly one comment, and all of these are to clarify some clutter in my own mind.
Your what?
To clarify some clutter in my mind. And the first one, you mentioned at one time there were Brahmins and there were Sankhyans, and I always understood that Sankhyans accepted Brahmins and all the other castes under that same umbrella. And I could be wrong. Could you clarify that for me?
Well, we don't really know what the Sankhyans did in practice. Are you talking about in practice or in theory?
Both. I'm talking in context of what you spoke a while ago, and I was not clear in my mind as to what I'm supposed to understand.
Well, I don't know what they did originally. You see, they claim that they were based on the Vedas. So if you're talking about the overall philosophy or religion, then I would say, yes, they're not much. The Sankhyans didn't differ very much from the Brahmins as far as their origin and sources are concerned. But the Sankhyans became a sect. There's no question about that. They became an argumentative sect who disputed with Brahmins, because we find the disputations of the Sankhyans and the Brahmins. That's the only thing I'm saying there about that. Any other questions?
Can I say something about that? I think Sankhyans did not accept, I don't think they had the concept of Brahman. It is not really the Brahmin caste,
no.
But it's more the concept of
Brahman. Brahman, yes, yes.
You see, I think that's probably what Swami meant to say, that it is the, there is a, I guess you can call it Brahmanism, which is accepting that the ultimate reality is Brahman.
Would you put the AC on?
Which a Sankhya did not accept, and Buddha did not accept also, you know. I would say that Buddha was silent about it because he probably thought that it is really no use discussing this. Mm-hmm. Because even the concept of Brahman, Swami may disagree with me, maybe everybody might disagree with me here, that coming down to the level, even Shankara said that it has to be taken upon faith at some point, you see. Because, you know, when Buddhists keep on arguing regressively, they come to say that you can never really win this argument. That's probably why Buddha probably thought that it is no use really discussing this.
Yeah, he does.
And that's why he was quiet. And that may have been misinterpreted as being atheistic. And I would say that Buddha was actually far wiser, in a way, to say that, or at least not put forth an argumentative or even a quest of Brahman in terms of intellectual.
Well, Buddha took the steam out of the Sankhyas. That Sankhya movement disappeared. It dried up, and Buddha... the people who had been thinking like that became Buddhists. That's what happened. Do you have something else?
Yeah. Second, the idea of Purusha and Prakriti in Buddhism, can you throw a little bit more light on that?
No, there is no Purusha and Prakriti. There's only Prakriti.
Only Prakriti.
I didn't make that clear. Yeah, Prakriti only. Prakriti and its evolutes. Purusha is not there. Yeah. Any other questions?
You said that Buddhism had spread throughout the world or through the United States, attributing that to an evangelical sort of...
Yes.
The question I had was, I've thought perhaps it might, the success, if you want to call it success, it's had, might be because of its adaptability.
Yeah. I'm sure you're right. That's why I've said that simple formula of ethic, mm-hmm. moral as practicable ethic, an adaptable ethic, yes.
If it's an ethic, then you don't have to worry about the impinging on people's feelings about the sacredness of their particular religion.
Not only that, but you know, the monastic dialogue has flourished in the world between the Catholic monks and nuns and the Buddhist monks and nuns over the subject of meditation, not other things. They get together on meditating together, but they don't discuss theology. They don't discuss Jesus, or they don't discuss Buddha as people. They discuss just how to meditate and how to feel good with one another.
Then the question is, if Vedanta has been elevated to the position of a science, should it, or is it advisable that it consider freeing itself of its Hindu roots, or is that possible?
I wouldn't think it would ever be completely possible.
I agree.
But in America, if it doesn't separate itself from some of its Hindu roots, it will not spread. That is for sure.
That's a big order.
Yes. Well, it depends on which roots you're talking about. Some of its roots it has to keep. And some of its roots will have to go. And the fine line is to find that line.
Is anyone working on trying to
Yeah, I'm
that's precisely where
that's
I was going
what,
with
what
this.
I appreciate.
But in lining out those roots that must stay, and those branches that perhaps could be examined for potential pairing, maybe that's a subject for open forum.
Well, I think that's the main subject of my my elocutionary work. I'm trying to teach that kind of discrimination between the things that are not necessary for us to copy and the things which are not familiar to us but nevertheless very essential. Because we can't just live in familiarity all our lives, you know, all our generations. Any other questions I have today? Well, before we say our benediction, I have a couple of announcements. One is that this